This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Well, thank you for coming. Welcome to everyone, and thanks for coming this afternoon. I'm Michael Provence, and I teach Middle Eastern history here at UCSD. I'm going to introduce our discussion. Our distinguished panelists will each speak for about 15 minutes. They're sitting over here for the purposes of not anonymity, but television, since the camera can't move around. And then they'll each come up here as we proceed. And then after they each say a little bit about the topics outlined there, we'll have a discussion, and everybody will be here. So this is the format, and that's why you can't see any of your panelists now. The discussion, the forum this afternoon has been sponsored by the Deans of Humanities, Social Sciences, ICAS, IRPS, and UCSD-TV. These last two acronyms, ICAS and IRPS, UCSD loves acronyms. IRPS stands for International Relations and Pacific Studies, and ICAS stands for International Institute of Comparative and Area Studies. Those two I's always trip me up. Now, I want to point out that Iraq, like every country, has a population that is evenly divided between men and women. And I apologize that our panel this afternoon is men are overrepresented. And I want to point out that next month, on the 11th of April, Orit Bashkin of the University of Chicago will be coming to speak about the Jewish populations of Iraq. And you are all welcome, and I hope you can attend. That's on the 11th of April. You'll find information about that on the ICAS webpage. So the five of us began talking a few months ago, and we focused on the expectation that there would be little appetite for public discussion of the costs and consequences of the invasion of Iraq 10 years ago this month. We figured and we were afraid that the date would pass unnoticed and unmarked and that there would continue to be no public discussion or processing of what had happened and why and what it meant. And so we wanted to offer a kind of a public accounting of this recent past. And so we're here especially to discuss what the war meant for Iraqis. This is our emphasis because despite the fact that Iraq was the target of the invasion, and despite the fact that we know the reasons given for the war have turned out to be untrue, and despite the fact that we have neighbors, tens of thousands of Iraqi neighbors here in San Diego, who know the trauma of the war not as warriors or as soldiers, but as civilians, mothers, fathers, grandparents, and children, fleeing for their lives, we know little and discuss less the experience from their perspective. Last week I was talking to my mother. She said, "I won't come. It's too depressing." One of my neighbors said to me, this is my greengrocer, who is a treasure of our community, said, "I can't go. I am too angry about what happened to my country." Now, of course, they're both right. It's depressing, and many people, including American citizens and people in the military, should be angry. But it takes energy to be angry or even to care at all. And unless you find other people who also care, it can drain you. But if we don't remember, and we don't give voice to anger and to depression, someday soon you'll turn on the TV and hear someone saying, "Well, it wasn't really all that bad. And besides, it was all with the best of intentions, and we don't have to worry about that anymore." But on this panel today are three Middle Eastern historians, one public health physician, and one cultural critic of Southern California. We are optimists. We have to be optimists, so it won't be all gloom and doom. We have to be optimists for reasons of psychological self-preservation as Middle Eastern historians and physicians and historians of California. So the Iraq War was a tragedy completely made by human beings, but Iraq is not a tragic country, and its people are not tragic people. And it was and is and will continue to be a font of all human history and the original home of human civilization And it's the homeland, in fact, the motherland of everyone on earth, it seems to me. Baghdad was the seat of the seat and the capital of the Abbasid Caliphate from 750 to 1250, the original city of peace, or Medina as-Salam. Already then, more than 1,000 years ago, it had been a capital for several empires. It's the land of the first written law code. If someone cuts down a tree on someone else's land, he must pay for it. This is one of the laws, 3,000 years ago. For millennia, it's been a world capital of art, music, architecture, and poetry, especially poetry. Among the Arabs, Turks, and Persians, it is a city and region renowned for culture and gracious hospitality. Now, the history is important, not only because we're historians, but the history is important because to appreciate the history, art, and culture, and humanity of other people is to make blind fear and ignorance and violence more difficult, and to make it more difficult to fear our neighbors as undifferentiated enemies. So if we appreciate the human qualities of others and their culture and history, and their rights as equal to our own, it's less likely that they can be that we can be collectively convinced of the efficacy and inevitability of war and violent conflict generally. 10 years ago, the war was preceded by the largest anti-war marches in history. Millions marched and protested all over the world, and I'm sure that there are many people here tonight who participated in these protests and these marches. And no one knows how close those protests came to derailing the war 10 years ago this month. But we know that people all over the world stood together and had a voice together, and this was not a wasted effort. So in the years since the end of the U.S. occupation, a movement called the Arab Spring has emerged in the region. And some people have tried to convince us that this Arab Spring movement for rights and dignity has a connection with the war on Iraq. This is nonsense. It's fallacious. Anthony Shadid, who was I introduced on this podium a few years ago, the distinguished Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times correspondent, said, the late and much lamented New York Times correspondent, said that he thought the Iraq War postponed the Arab Spring and the struggle for rights in the region. And it seems to me that he has to have been correct, and it's hard to imagine how war can advance a movement for rights and dignity and accountability of governments to citizens. So if the Arab Spring movements have an origin point, it might be the day a young journalist named Montaz Razaidi stood up during a press conference in Baghdad in late 2008 and threw his shoes at the President of the United States and said, "This is for the widows and the orphans, you dog." Like much else about the period, Montaz Razaidi was ignored for the most part in the United States and forgotten. And, of course, it didn't help that no one could pronounce his name properly in this country. But throughout the Middle East, of course, he was lauded as a hero and a person who's remembered still, a hero of dignity and rights and nonviolence. So it seems to me that it's his example that we ought to keep in mind. And his example we have to emulate and not forget so that we can salvage something from the suffering and the wreckage and the destruction of the war. So I'd like to introduce our panelists now. I'll start in the order that they'll speak, and they'll come up, and after I introduce each of them, they'll come up and take my place here, and then we'll all sit down over here after we finish. The first is Professor Hassan Kayla, who teaches in the History Department and is the founding director of Middle Eastern Studies here at UCSD. He studied at Harvard University, where he received his bachelor's degree and his PhD in Middle Eastern History and Studies. He's the author of Arabs and Young Turks, which has been published, translated into Arabic and Turkish. Sorry, Hassan. Probably soon to be translated into Persian. He's written on the administration of the Arab provinces in the late Ottoman Empire and nationalism and rival ideologies in this period of the 1920s and before. Now, Professor Kayla has taken part in many Iraq War teach-ins on this campus since he arrived at UCSD in 1990. Yeah, so this includes the Gulf War of 1991, the events of 2002, 2003, and so he is our archive, our living archive of anti-war activism on this campus with us today. After Hassan will be Dr. Wael El-Delaimi over here, who is a professor of epidemiology. I said it, epidemiology. And chief, I'm pleased with myself for that. you can say it easily, but for me it's a little more challenging. And chief of the Division of Global Public Health in the Department of Family and Preventative Medicine. He was educated in Baghdad and New Zealand, and he was a research fellow at Harvard and at the UN Human World Health Organization. His research is focusing on chronic diseases in the developing world and public health in other countries, and especially tobacco and things of this nature. Now, he every summer, for several summers now, he has taken UCSD undergraduates, pre-med students, undergraduates, I think, right? To Jordan to work among Iraqi refugees in Jordan. And he'll talk about human rights and public health in Iraq since 2003. Ibrahim El-Marashi, I'm losing track of my pages here. I put numbers on them, but sometimes it doesn't work. Ibrahim El-Marashi is our third speaker. He teaches Middle Eastern history at Cal State San Marcos, and his research deals with the history of modern Iraq. He's the co-author of Iraq's Armed Forces in Analytical History. He received his DPhil at Oxford University, completing a thesis on the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait. He's an Iraqi-American who lived at various times in Saudi Arabia, Yemen, Egypt, Morocco, and Turkey, and he's traveled in many other countries of the region. Professor El-Marashi has an unbelievable story to tell, a personal connection to what he is going to tell us about and what he calls selling the war. And we are you will be electrified, I promise, by what he has to say. And finally, we have Mike Davis with us today, who will talk about Mike Davis, like myself, is a Ibn al-Balad, son of East County. And he will talk about the Iraqi refugees and immigrants in East County and in our region generally. He is a professor in the Department of Creative Writing at UC Riverside. He's a MacArthur Fellow. This is the genius grant. He recently received a Lannan Literary Foundation Award for nonfiction. This is an unbelievably prestigious grant. He's the author of more than 20 books and 100 articles. His work spans urban studies, the built environment, economic history, and social movements. He's the author of City of Quartz, Excavating the Future in Los Angeles, which I and lots of other people, including a number of LA Times columnists, think is the best nonfiction book, one of the two best nonfiction books ever written about Los Angeles, City of Quartz. The only thing is that he's written one of the other two best nonfiction books about Los Angeles, Ecology of Fear. You should all read Under the Perfect Sun, The San Diego Tourists Never See, which he was the co-author of and published a few years ago. And he will speak about the Iraqi refugees here in San Diego and other things. So thank you very much. Thank you for coming. We'll start with Professor Kyla now.
Thanks, Michael. I'd like to thank Michael for his stewardship in planning this event. When he first conceived it, he suggested that I talk about past campus responses to war and campus activism. As he said, I came here the year of the first Gulf War in 1990. He came in 2003. In fact, his joining the UCSD faculty was one auspicious consequence, if you like, a collateral benefit of the mayhem in the Middle East, which awakened at UCSD an unexpected and unlikely interest in that part of the world. Now, what Michael has heard from me about past UCSD activities around the Middle East or the Middle East wars must have spiked his attention in view of the fact that the campus has been quiescent in this regard in the last 10 years. Indeed, the campus has been a microcosm of the broader American society, at least since those demonstrations that Michael referred to at the very beginning of the war. In terms of the dearth of introspection or critical debate about our involvement in Iraq. Allow me then to say something about campus responses in the past in the context of the broader activism and debates about the war and the questions of the role and responsibilities of the university community. And departing from the main theme of this gathering, the consequences of the war, I will go back to its precedents, namely the first Gulf War in 1990, which I suspect will come up in this discussion as a precursor of the 2003 war. And I will start with the run-up to that war in 1990-1991 with the purpose of highlighting the contrasts it posed to the student and public engagement since 2003. Modern student activism was, of course, spawned by the Vietnam War in the 1960s. This was the founding period of our university. It was also a period of political engagement and activism on this campus that has become legendary in California, if not in the nation. When I came to UCSD in the summer of 1990, during the turbulent days of the internationalization of the Gulf crisis, which was triggered by Saddam Hussein's invasion of Kuwait in August, I stepped into that venerable tradition on the campus. There was palpable engagement and concern about the inexorable march toward war. As soon as the turn started, a large group of staff and faculty from across the campus organized meetings to talk about the war and plan campus events against the background of U.S. troop buildup in Saudi Arabia under Operation Desert Shield. The students organized separately on their initiative and in communication with the faculty staff group went on to plan a major rally and teach-in to be held immediately following the winter vacation. The rally was scheduled to take place at the Price Center, at Price Center Plaza, but it had to be moved in the last minute to the Mandeville Auditorium due to the first rainstorm of that drought year, producing a huge overflow crowd. The participants in these campus activities came, and these activities also included smaller events such as teach-ins sponsored by the departments, came from diverse disciplines and backgrounds. They urged open discussion and aimed at consciousness building about the war. The positions proffered and the opinions voiced reflected the broader debate on the national agenda, but activism was especially vigorous on the campus. In the summer and fall of 1990, this debate included questions such as whether vital U.S. interests were threatened by Saddam Hussein's action, what the impact of war on the delicate regional balances would be, what the ecological implications of modern warfare might be in the region, in this region of the world's largest oil operations. What would be its implications in terms of human casualties? The shadow of Vietnam War was prominently in the backdrop of these debates. Was the U.S. embarking on an imperial adventure in an increasingly unipolar world that could result in a drawn-out quagmire? In the context of these debates, the question of the university's role in times of national and international crisis came under the spotlight. A question worth thinking about for all of us today, at least the students. The faculty staff group called on all instructors to allow their classes to attend the campus rally or instead devote the class hour to a discussion of the Gulf crisis and the call for war. You may have seen earlier this week, the president of Oberlin College made a similar call, responding to the university community outrage triggered by racist incidents on that campus. Classes were canceled and everyone was invited to a teach-in. Some students and faculty took exception to the plea to devote class time to the discussion of war here in 1990. I recall that a colleague from the chemistry department, for instance, argued that it would have been entirely appropriate for him to depart from his syllabus, and had there been, for example, a chlorine leak in the campus or in the city pool that caused casualties, but that it would be wrong for him to talk in class about a subject that was not within his professional expertise. A few parents called the chancellor's office, urging that students attend the lectures they had registered and paid for. The chancellor made a controversial statement to The Guardian, precisely decreeing that, a statement that suggested faculty that did not go about business as usual might be reprimanded. The question was raised in the next meeting at the Academic Senate and involved a heated faculty debate around the meaning and scope of academic freedom and the university's role in times of national crisis. The vigorous and engagement that occasioned the prelude to the first war against Iraq faded in the next two decades. The Gulf War of 1991 made a mockery of the specter of another Vietnam. The war was over within weeks with an overwhelming military victory of the United States and its allies. An army of 500,000 sustained only 200 fatalities, more from friendly fire and accidents than enemy action. Night after night, networks broadcast images of sorties deploying precision bombs in the methodical depiction of a clean and technologically cutting-edge war. There was no ground war to speak of, no draft, certainly no Vietnam, but only a quick, decisive, and ostensibly clean victory. Our wars had changed once and for all. The depiction of a surgical victory obviated any debate or discussion and snuffed out the enormous human, political, social, economic consequences of the war on the region. The course and the result of the first Gulf War had a sobering effect on critical debate on war. If an unimaginable military victory stifled public debate about matters of war and U.S. involvement in the Middle East, on the campuses and elsewhere, an unimaginable tragedy and affront cemented the inertia after September 11 against our sense of loss, disbelief, and incomprehension occasioned by the tragic events of that day. The academe was unable to heed President Bush's advice in the days following September 11, namely to continue business as usual, which would have entailed educating the public on issues of public policy, in this case pertaining to warfare in Afghanistan and later Iraq. It failed to do so in part because, as a nation, we took to heart a different dictum the President, President George Bush enunciated, namely, you are either with us or against us, which rendered patriotism synonymous with consent with the administration's policies, while it cast suspicion on debate and stigmatized dissent. A full-throttle neoconservative campaign against academic freedoms backed by top advisors in the administration, complete with vigilantism and blacklists, was waged in the name of national security, with a chilling effect on debate and dissent. As the country moved towards its next military involvement, the university, by and large, was quiescent, with no grassroots activism or spirit of engagement. In the absence of debate and reliable information on Iraq's capabilities and motives, we all became onlookers to the push for a new war against Iraq, which was launched 10 years ago this week. In the months before the declaration of war, several campus units co-organized a panel discussion, which was held on October 13th, coincidentally the same day that the House of Representatives authorized President Bush to use force in Iraq. In addition to a couple of faculty from history and IRPS, a political science professor from Berkeley, a former nuclear weapons inspector from the Monterey Institute, an international law professor from California Western Law School explored the circumstances of the thrust towards war. Even though the campus had been by and large quiet and had been overtaken by the broader San Diego community in terms of engagement, some 200 students showed up. The panel discussed the merits of the administration's argument for attacking Iraq with a great deal of skepticism, especially that Saddam Hussein possessed and was poised to deploy weapons of mass destruction, and that his regime was linked to Al-Qaeda. At the end of the panel, a member of the audience, a confused member of the audience, pressed us to venture our best explanation of why President Bush might be going to war. Each panelist offered a very different explanation. In the midst of such uncertainty and confusion, and against an assiduous campaign by the administration to market the war to the American public, we entered a conflict that has been waged out of sight and out of mind, but at tremendous cost for a decade. Unfortunately, as Michael said, this 10th anniversary of the war has generated little interest in taking stock of the last decade. We can begin to change that, at least on this campus today. I'm very encouraged by seeing a lot of students here. And I thank Michael again for putting us as a university on the map to initiate a public discussion of the Iraq War, its broader repercussions, its legacy, and its lessons. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Hassan. I slightly messed up the order there when I introduced people, so Ibrahim al-Marashi will be next.
Okay, thank you. It's I find it kind of ironic that I am speaking after Professor Hassan Kayala, because right after the 1991 Gulf War, I was a young undergraduate sitting in Professor Kayala's class, getting my first introduction to Middle Eastern history. Never could I have imagined 20 years later I would be following him in a discussion about a war that I had just lived through. Now, the 1991 war was a defining moment for myself, because as an Iraqi American, when I had just entered UCSD as a freshman, or first year, sorry, I had just witnessed an event. Well, I had just witnessed the 91 Gulf War. And I remember as kind of a senior in high school, the typical American, probably senior, he's worried, or he or she is worried about the prom or getting into college. My defining moment in my senior year in high school was an uprising launched by my fellow Iraqis. And what I remember from that uprising was this. After the 1991 Gulf War, 15 out of Iraq's 18 provinces were up in revolt and in the hands of various rebels, both in the south and in the north. Okay. What it seemed to me was that the Iraqis were on the brink of establishing a government of their own and overthrowing the government of Saddam Hussein. After all, the government of George Bush at that time had called upon the Iraqis to rise up and take affairs into their own hands. Okay. And recalling that uprising that was now not only taken part among the, not only did the Kurds in the north of Iraq take part in this uprising, but the surprising thing was the spark for that uprising was actually an Arab Sunni military officer who began the uprising by launching a tank shell into a portrait of Saddam Hussein in Basra. A military officer who had just survived the war realized that the Iraqi military had been left to be slaughtered against coalition forces and did something unheard of, actually physically attack a manifestation of the Saddam Hussein government. So it was a joint, we could say it was involved the Iraqi Shia, the Arab Sunnis, Arab Shia, as well as the Kurds. But as the uprising unfolded, as it became known, the Iraqi uprising, you see how close U.S. forces were to the actual events. And as this uprising progressed, Not only did the U.S. forces that had captured equipment from the Iraqi military refuse to hand it over to the Iraqi rebels, okay, the U.S. government had also permitted Iraq's government to utilize its helicopters, which were crucial for the Iraqi state to crush the uprising in the north and south. As the uprising was brutally crushed, the justification for the U.S. not taking an active stance in helping the Iraqi rebels, even though it was attributed to, George Bush's call for an uprising, was this. Back in 1991, Washington was wary of this uprising's success, because if this uprising would have succeeded, the Iraqis would have created a Shia government sympathetic to Iran, as well as a de facto semi-independent Kurdish state, which was what Washington did not want in 1991. Now, let's jump back to 2003, 10 years after the Iraq War, billions of dollars spent, the loss of thousands of American lives, the loss of hundreds of thousands of Iraqi lives. Where are we? What we have, more or less, is an Iraqi government dominated by the Shia and sympathetic to Iran, and a semi-de facto independent Kurdish state in the north. What America did not want in 1991, it fought for to achieve in 2013. And that's what I find quite ironic. Now, what does this have to do with the actual process of selling the war? I'll come to that. But remember this experience in 1991, and because not only did it left me kind of very embittered, but you could imagine that the rebels who were taking part in this uprising and thinking they would get American help, you could imagine that they would be skeptical of American promises. Okay, and this is key to when we jump to the events of 2003. Now, I'm talking about selling the war and its consequences. So now, for some of you, the notion of war as something to be sold might be counterintuitive. So as a historian, let me give you kind of a historical context of at least the birth of selling wars in the American tradition. It could be traced back to the War of 1898, when you have phrases such as, remember the Maine, okay? This kind of phrase that summed up America's reason for getting involved in the Spanish-American War. Remembering the Maine was very much something that was produced. It was contrived, but it was supposed to justify an American engagement and a foreign adventure. Okay. World War I. Okay. If you look at World War I, America enters the war quite late, but even entering the war, entering the war had to be sold to the American public. Now, who sells war? Well, but it's the same people who sell you products. And the thinking was in those days, if people can sell you products, surely they can sell justifications for war. So the same person who made it acceptable for women to smoke in public, you probably wouldn't realize before, let's say, around World War I, a woman could never smoke in public, okay? The person who gave us advertisements like this, the notion of cigarettes can be sold to women, the same person who made it acceptable that you can eat bacon during breakfast. Now, this might be a shock to you. Don't question this. But did you ever think about that? Why eat a shriveled piece of pig meat during breakfast? Okay, somebody had to sell that notion to you. The same people who sold you the notion of a coffee break. In theory, when you get a break off work, that's all it is. How did it become conflated with a coffee break? It was the same thing. People had to sell you the notion that when you take your break from work, you have to drink coffee along with it. It was exactly those same people. Particularly the smoking campaign was launched by people such as Edward Bernays, the nephew of Sigmund Freud. And they represented a generation of what today we call the Madison Avenue. But Madison Avenue sold Americans its entry into World War I. This was the kind of bringing together advertisement executives to sell foreign policy. It really took off during World War I, and then it never ended. Okay, the notion that entering a war had to be sold. Now, it's the same people who brought you. This is some of the products of World War I. In fact, this was actually copied from an earlier British image of the same. In this case, this was Lord Kitchener. And, of course, sometimes these images then kind of get appropriated on popular culture without us questioning how did these images emerge. And all of these images emerge through a process of selling war. Okay. Now, Let's jump to the 2003 Iraq War and look at kind of one of the iconic images that sold America's entry into the war. And that was when Colin Powell made this presentation in front of the United Nations Security Council and showed this vial of what was supposed to be anthrax. Okay? And what really clinched that presentation was this visual. And what did that visual do was he said that this much anthrax is enough. Does anyone remember how much could it wipe out? Almost several blocks of Manhattan. Okay. And what he says was, Iraq had an anthrax program in the past, and if Al-Qaeda could get their hands on this much anthrax, that it could wreak havoc in the United States. And it was that kind of conflation of two entities, Iraq and Al-Qaeda, that sold the war. You had to kind of sell the war just as, you know, most advertising products play upon our fears. Okay, we buy low-fat yogurt because we fear becoming overweight. We buy, you know, so-and-so because we fear heart disease. It was the same thing. We bought the war, metaphorically, because we feared this outcome. And when I, during this period, it forced me to kind of go back to the kind of the science of weapons of mass destruction, because I started to question, you know, first of all, I was aware that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, but in, you know, during the Iran-Iraq War, if anything, Iraq was using it against its own people. If anything anyone suffered from Iraq's weapons of mass destruction, it was the Iraqis. But once I started examining the science behind this, anthrax is a biological weapon. Okay? And the important thing about biological weapons is this: they're biological. They die. Okay? And as I began studying, I realized that even biological or chemical weapons, now the program more or less was dismantled by the mid-90s due to the UN inspection process. If Iraq did have any chemical or biological weapons, by 2003, they should be dead. They should be ineffective. Okay? But nevertheless, Colin Powell says, no, we have intelligence that the WMDs exist. Okay? And the thing is, when he uses that word intelligence, intelligence for me in those days was beyond in scrutiny, okay? This was my impression, that if Iraq had WMDs, they're surely ineffectual by now. But nevertheless, he has information I don't, okay? He has access to the CIA, to the NSA, National Security Agency. So obviously, the U.S. government knows something that I don't, okay? But it was interesting that during the same performance with the vial of anthrax, he also referred to a British intelligence dossier, okay, that, you know, which he congratulated. He said, thanks to, you know, my colleagues across the Atlantic, this also shows a threat posed by Saddam Hussein of Iraq. Now, what he was referring to, and it's ironic that the episode that would later develop from that reference to the document, it didn't make too much headlines in the U.S. I find it ironic that, you know, one of the kind of crack.com, which is a political parody site, and it's not even political parody, it's just a general parody site, okay? But I find it ironic that it's a website like this that got that brought the most attention to this issue, okay? And what are they saying? 5 clues hidden in computer files that can get you busted. And what are they referring to, number 5? Word document reveals that the Iraqi invasion was based on plagiarized college essays. Okay? Now, which plagiarized college essay are they referring to? It's a college essay I wrote. Okay? In other words, what is the British government doing? It's a little bit more than a college essay. I was in a PhD program at that time, but what had happened was an article I had written about Iraq, really under the 1991 Iraqi government. But it wasn't necessarily about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction, program. It was about how Saddam Hussein stayed in power. And it wasn't a fantastic paper either. I mean, whether you're a student as an undergrad when I first entered your class or whether I'm a PhD student, I still leave things to the last minute. I still procrastinate. And that paper I produced was very much a product of procrastination. But that product is what the British government copied. In other words, to get information about Saddam Hussein's Iraq, apparently there was not enough information in their archives. It was simply quicker to just go to Yahoo in those days before Google rose, type in Iraq intelligence services, my article would be the first that popped up, copy and paste it into a Word document. They didn't even bother making a PDF file. And present it to the British Parliament. And the British Parliament is basically looking at this and thinking this is recent intelligence. Then Colin Powell takes it to the UN and says this is cutting-edge intelligence. Okay. When it turns out that this document is plagiarized, in the UK at least, it was the beginning of kind of a red flag, that if this is being copied from a PhD student in Oxford, perhaps then the whole entire war that it's being constructed, if it's the way it's being sold, should be questioned. That happened in the UK. It didn't happen in the US. Okay? The Fourth Estate, our media didn't question the selling process, I would argue. Okay? And that's what I'm saying. How does the story get attention? It's through crack.com. It's not the New York Times that's giving it prominence. It's not the Washington Post. It's a parody web page. Finally, then, the war proceeds, and we have terminology like this, shock and awe. Okay? Now, did anyone ever question where did the term shock and awe come from to describe the initial phase of the military aspect of the war? Okay? And almost 10 years later, one of the consequences of the Iraq War is the term shock and awe has almost become banal. In the television show Desperate Housewives, if you remember, Brie Vandekamp, I remember, it says uses that terminology. She was going to use shock and awe against a rival housewife. Okay, if you want to sell used cars, what are you going to say? Our prices are going to shock and awe you. Okay, think about how much war terminology is part of our everyday lexicon. Okay, whether it's a blitzkrieg, which we now use in football games, the mother of all battles has become, which she used to describe the 91 Gulf War, has become the mother of all sales, so on and so forth. Shock and awe is a product of your taxpayer dollar. Excuse me. Shock and awe is a product of a government spokesman. It was meant to sell the overwhelming nature of U.S. military might. Okay. Shock and awe came from the same people who brought you World War I, and We Want You, and Uncle Sam Wants You. It was crafted. It was an advertising slogan. Who's going to be shocked and awe? It's going to be the Iraqis. But it was also a way to say that this is going to be a fight that Iraq couldn't win. Now, if we go from shock and awe, what about the entire nature of the Iraq War? How is that packaged? And I juxtapose these images on purpose. And actually, I gave Luke a lightsaber here. But no, anyway. Why am I juxtaposing these images? Because I'm trying to make an argument that not only kind of phrases were packaged and sold, such as shock and awe, not only was fear sold to you, such as the anthrax scare, okay? But if you watch the news, particularly, let's say, from a channel like this, I don't want to specifically mention it, but not even Fox News, you can look at any of the news programs in the U.S., such as CNN. The news of the 2003 Iraq War that you watched, had you watched Al Jazeera, for example, you would be almost watching an entirely different conflict. Because in this case, the way the war was kind of packaged now, this is by our mainstream media, almost corresponded to kind of a three-act play. Okay. I wouldn't even actually, no, that's complimenting our media. I would say it's a three-act blockbuster. Think more of Bruce Willis than a play. But in other words, let me try to explain it to you. And this is how I watched the Iraq War as a three-act play. Okay, and what did we have on the first day of the Iraq War? And what do you have in a blockbuster? You have your teaser, a lot of intense action. And if you remember the first day of the Iraq War, how did it begin? It began with a decapitation strike. A lot of explosions, but did our antagonist, Saddam Hussein, die in that strike? No. Okay, which is good, because you don't want the movie to end in Act One. Okay. And then if you remember, what's part of kind of any classic narrative is you have your protagonist, antagonist, and up and down leading up to a final climax and resolution. Okay, and if you think of kind of how the Iraq War was portrayed in the news media over the couple of weeks, we had our Act One. Do our protagonists, the American soldiers, enter Iraq without any difficulties? No. They had this confrontation in Nasiriyah. You had a young woman who's captured by Iraqi forces. Our protagonists were facing desert storms in outside of the Karbala Gap. So you had all these kind of issues that are, the protagonists were facing. And they eventually overcome them. Okay. The prisoner of war is rescued from the hospital. The desert storm ends and our forces, you know, move on. And then you finally have that kind of climactic scene of, you know, American forces entering Baghdad and bringing down the statue of Saddam Hussein. And that was kind of, I found, Act 3, the climax of the film. And then you have your resolution, okay? Whether it's George Bush landing on the aircraft carrier declaring mission accomplished, or Luke Skywalker, you know, landing after destroying the Death Star, okay? You have the resolution, okay? So that war became entertainment as well as conveying information, okay? And I found that all is kind of a process of communicating, selling war. Now, why do I have a picture of my grandfather here? Well, it goes like this. The Iraq War was a convenient three-act play, okay? But what happened after the invasion and what took policy planners by complete surprise was that the Iraq War didn't end with Act 3 and, you know, our resolution, mission accomplished, okay? No, the movie was going to keep on going. And that what emerged that took U.S. policy planners by complete surprise was an Iraqi insurgency, okay? What happened here? Okay. The Iraq War, towards its end, was sold as a liberation. Okay. Operation Iraqi Freedom was supposed to be, you're selling a war as a liberation. Okay. The point is this, though, and any kind of, the first lesson you would get in a communication studies course is this. When somebody has a message, the way they craft that message and the way that message is received are two different processes. In other words, the message you intend in your head and the way that message will be received are two completely different processes. In other words, you can craft a message. You have no control over its reception. In other words, the war was sold, let's say, to the American public, if I could generalize, as the liberation of Iraq, okay? But the problem was you were also trying to sell that same message to the Iraqi people, okay? The U.S. was trying to kind of craft a message to the Iraqis, we came here to liberate you. Okay, now remember back to the events of 1991, okay? And you can understand why, you know, within the span of, you know, a little bit more than 10 years, why the Iraqis might have been skeptical of that liberation message, okay, number one. And number two was that it's ironic that the British came with the same message right around the conclusion of World War I. The British had entered Iraq and exactly told the same thing to those people who would later become the citizens of Iraq. They were then living under the Ottoman Empire. The British said, "We came here and liberated you from the Turk." Okay. But the thing is, that's the way the message wasn't received. For number one, they didn't even understand the notion, what is a Turk? Okay, back then, most Iraqis considered themselves Ottomans. The notion of ethnicity didn't even exist really back then. But when my grandfather, who was living in Iraq at that time, heard that message, that's not what he received. Okay? What he received was this. Okay, I'm not sure who are these Turks you're talking about. I don't consider, you know. But who was this person living in Najaf, my grandfather? He was ethnically Iranian, okay? But when a state called Iraq is formed, what is he thinking is that, okay, you British might come here and tell me you've just liberated me, but this is all I know. I'm a Muslim, you British soldiers are not, and it's my duty to take up a gun and try to overthrow you guys, okay? What happens, and this is what was in my DNA, what emerges in Iraq is an insurgency. And almost it's almost the same process that occurs after 2003. And that's what I found shocking, was that why did the insurgency take, you know, U.S. policy planners by surprise? It happened once. What would, in the 1970s, what would, 1980? What would be different in 2003? Okay. 1920 is a period, series of events known as the Great Iraqi Revolution. The British called it an insurgency. They almost used the exact same language. But yes, my grandfather was an insurgent. Wasn't a very good one. He got arrested, I think, within an hour. And but the interesting thing is, I think they threw him in prison, and the guy guarding the prison was also an Iraqi and happened to be my grandfather's neighbor. And, you know, that's the problem when you don't do your own policing. They let him out, and, of course, he fled to an island called Zanzibar, not the cafe in Pacific Beach, the island off the East African coast, okay? And I show you this to kind of, again, show you that you could sell liberation. It doesn't mean that's how the people will receive your message. And he definitely didn't receive that message back then. A question that's always asked me, 10 years, particularly in this 10-year anniversary, was the Iraq War about oil? Okay, yes, of course. That's what I heard. It's tricky. Now, and I'll tell you why it's tricky to answer that question as a historian. Because always when you know, when I'm asked this question, it's always difficult as a historian to respond. Okay? Because I have to say, as a historian, my duty is, you know, what do the documents tell me? Okay? And then again, what do the documents not tell me? Okay? And of course, you're never going to find, you know, a magical document written by George Bush saying, I'm going to invade Saddam because he tried to kill, you know, I'm going to invade Iraq because Saddam killed my daddy and tried to kill my daddy and I want a lot of oil. Of course, you're not going to find that magical document, okay? And of course, even studying U.S. foreign policy itself is quite difficult. It's, which agency of the U.S. government are you talking about? We're really talking about U.S. foreign policies around 2003. Are we talking about the policy of the State Department, Department of Defense, the executive branch? And so usually my response is this, again as a historian, is don't... What George Bush was thinking in his head, or Rumsfeld, or Cheney, we will never know. We have no way of, you know, Jedi mind tricks, you know, of going into their heads. You can tell I'm a Star Wars fan. Okay. But never, we have no way of knowing that. The question maybe we should be asking ourselves is how the justification gets remembered in the public. And what I find is these kind of images, or Jay Leno making this joke, as we head to war with Iraq, President Bush wants to make one thing clear. This war is not about oil, it's about gasoline. Okay. Or even read the text of this image that came. This is MSN.com. This is where I would go to log in into Hotmail. Okay. But what do we see in this description? Okay. Cars that increase the fun factor. In this year of the Iraq War, in America's show of military might, the 2003 Hummer H2 has to be on the list. What other new vehicle can combine an in-your-face military image with country club flair like this one can? How many of these are on the road today? Not too much because it consumes a lot of gas. But of course, you know, remember, this was, you know, you're not only celebrating war, we assume it was a celebration of kind of access to a lot of oil. To answer the question, was the Iraq War about oil? If you ask me today, I would say no. If you look at who won the Iraqi government oil contracts. American companies did quite poorly in bidding for the oil contracts, if you look at that. Of course, now they're trying to get into northern Iraqi oil fields, but that's another matter, okay? But maybe the more important point is, do we remember the Iraq War about being a liberation or as being a war about oil? And I would argue as a public, as kind of the historical popular opinion, it's definitely the war for oil, and I'm using that as a slogan, gets to be more remembered than, I would say, a war for liberating Iraq. And, of course, you have to look at these images. These images are not produced in isolation. I'm just trying to show you a general pattern, not only in kind of U.S. popular discourse, but this is also something produced from the Iraqi side. This reads in Arabic, the government of Maliki, a reference to the current Iraqi prime minister. But thanks, they still write oil for us. Even this Arabic cartoonist still, you know, assumes that every Arabic speaker is going to understand this imagery, okay? We have something in color saying the oil of Iraq, okay, with juxtaposing the oil of Iraq with the bloodshed that ensued. Okay? And even well beyond the Iraq War, what are we seeing in this imagery? Big oil find in Brazil. My fellow Americans, it's time we brought freedom to Brazil. Now, do you see what's happening here? It's that, and this is always the damage or the danger of advertising war, is that advertising can be turned back on its head. Okay, so here we see is kind of one piece of popular media taking the language to sell the war and turning it on its head. Okay, and if we finally look at this, this was when the Mars rover landed. What did these aliens say? We don't have any oil, do we? And that's what I'll say, 10 years after the war, what is one of the consequences is this is how the war is going to be remembered. Okay? If George Bush was worrying about how would you be remembered in history, this is where the trend is going to. Okay? And that's what I find fascinating about for all the efforts to sell the war, the public came back and kind of sold its own version for war. Liberating Iraq and no war for oil was what I see as the public's response. And that's what I kind of find quite fascinating, that for all the efforts to sell a war, the public can respond back. So we're not, you know, sure, good, you know, half of the U.S. public on the eve
of the conclusion of the 2003 Iraq War believed that there was a connection between Iraq and 9/11. That's half of the American public. Okay. But if you look at it, okay, half of the American public didn't believe in that connection. Okay. But if we talk about consequences, then still 50% was quite a large who believed in that connection. And I think this is the ultimate consequence in the lesson, is to kind of become more aware of the kind of narratives states weave about threats to America's national security. Because what did we see end up happening? And I'll conclude on this note. While weaving a narrative of a kind of non-existent threat, what happened was when you're also weaving the narrative, a lot of resources were diverted from Afghanistan to Iraq. Okay, and what did happen was, you know, the taking, you know, attention away from Afghanistan to Iraq, when U.S. forces could have been used, you know, the boots on the ground to rebuild the Afghan country, what happened was a lot was diverted, and you gave basically time for the, you know, the Taliban to regroup and rearm. So sometimes these actions, or, you know, the kind of misconstruing threats to America's security, does actually have concrete consequences. And that's why I think America is living through today. It's the current war in Afghanistan, which America is still fighting, I would argue is a result of getting distracted by a non-existent threat in Iraq. And I'll conclude there. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone, for staying to hear us all. And who says that historians can't talk about public health? I just learned about the history of cigarettes and obesity and other stuff. And if I wasn't a physician or a public health person, I would have been a historian. That's why Mike has always been able to allure me to these talks. So I'm going to talk about what happened and continue from where Ibrahim has mentioned, and want to touch base on some of the health aspects, but also more importantly on human rights, because human rights and health go hand in hand. You can't separate them. And so there's a less attention by us in the health field into this aspect, and that's something that I am wanting to change, at least in my division. So after the war, everybody expected that things will be flowery, democracy will come usher in, everybody will be happy and rich, and every aspect of life will be better. Actually, it went totally opposite. And I don't want to go into the details, but I'm going to touch base on some of the reports 4 years and 10 years after the invasion. So this is from the UNICEF. The report in 2007 says the following, 4 years after. Children today are much worse off than they were a year or 3 years ago. That was by the time of the invasion. The basic Iraqi food basket was fairly secure under the regime of Saddam, and the government provided the food basket to each citizens, which was depleted after the invasion. Because of the violence, mothers were too afraid to send their children to school or take them to health centers to get checkups and nutritional supplements. 25,000 children per month were being displaced from their homes with their families. 75,000 children had resorted to living in camps or temporary shelters because the violence created one of the most the largest internal and external migration and refugees. Many of the 222,000 displaced children of primary school age had their education affected, in addition to 760,000 who did not even enroll. So this is quite bleak 4 years after. Then in a Lancet study, the Lancet is the premier journal in medicine, the assessment was that maternal mortality, this is 2008, doubled in 2006 compared to 2003. Up to 50% borrow money to pay their health costs, 30% have significant psychological distress, 50% of children are malnourished, 2,000 doctors got killed, and another 12,000 fled. and only 4% of the reconstruction budget went to healthcare. Now, how's it looking in 2012? Some minor improvement, but we still have 32% of children are deprived of basic rights. That's about 5.6 million children. 10 years, almost 10 years after the invasion, and after all the high prices of oil, you would think that there will be more oil than they could deal with. 25% of children have stunted physical and intellectual development due to undernutrition. All this is an indication of the failure of that this invasion has brought with it to the people of Iraq. One of the two major studies that were epidemiologically very refined and sophisticated. I'm an epidemiologist, so this is what we do. We assess the burden of disease in the population. When you go into a war zone or a conflict like what has been happening in Iraq, you need really advanced epidemiological methods and design to be able to get a good picture of what's happening in terms of health. And this is what the authors did from Johns Hopkins. In 2004, they did a study, and they estimated that 100,000 Iraqis, this is only 1 year after the invasion, died as a result of the invasion. And that the violence accounted for most of the excess death, and airstrikes from coalition forces accounted for the most violent deaths. Another follow-up study in 2006 estimated that from 50 clusters in 16 out of the 18 provinces that involved 12,000 people, they excluded Fallujah, the province of Ramadi, of Anbar, because there was an onslaught. A lot of people got killed there. So they didn't want to kind of that data point bring everything else, so they didn't do a survey there. And they found 600,000 excess. This is kind of a up to a million with a confidence interval that died. Another corroborating study, totally separate, did by a very prestigious British polling organization, and they polled 1,460 Iraqi adults, and they found 1.2 million died, were killed. So this is quite a cost for the invasion for the people of Iraq. So with that aspect, I want to kind of move into the Ministry of Health and from it to human rights, because there's a connection there. So the Ministry of Health in Iraq was a model for other places. They used to train people from other ministries of health from the region. It is sophisticated, well-established. What happened is they gave each ministry to according to each party. And one party that took this was the party of al-Mahdi, Jaish al-Mahdi, which is the army of Mahdi. And what they basically did is they made this as a staging ground for death squads. They used the ambulances in the ministry to carry death squads, to carry kidnapped people, to take people and kill them. The morgue, which was on control of the Ministry of Health, became a place of death for the relatives of the victims. So they would stand there, and they have these victims who are killed, and they know that this person is from this sect. This family came to pick up the body. They collect everyone, take them somewhere else, and kill them. And that way, everybody was afraid. I know personally people who had their family dead. They would send their neighbor, because he's from the sect that belongs to this people, to get the body. That is how bad it was. If that's not enough, the minister and the vice minister were actually operating a death squad, killing people. And one of the victims was the head of the health department in Diyala province in the east. He was given an appointment with the Minister of Health. He went there. He never came back. They found his body dumped in a dumpster somewhere in East Baghdad. It turned out this person, his name is Hakim Azzamili, who was the undersecretary, if we compare it to here, undersecretary of health. He's the vice minister. He was responsible for that. One of the few good things that the U.S. Army did is actually capture this guy. And they captured him and they put him in prison. And then they went and took him to court. There were witnesses that he did commit, not just this atrocities, but many others. As a result of intimidation, the witnesses were afraid, they were threatened, they knew that the threat was real, they declined to go, he was released. Guess what? He's now a member of the parliament. Okay, so another story people might have heard. This is the Minister of Interior, Jabir Solag. And beside him is the head of the police special forces, Adnan Thabit Samarrai. This is when the U.S. troops stumbled across a hidden and secret prison that was so disastrous in what they saw, 200 people cramped in a place with forms of torture, sick. Some of them had gangrene, and all of them didn't have any kind of thing they committed. They were just there, rounded up, and put there for months. So when this was released, this guy, the Minister of Interior, went out to defend that this is not, they were terrorists, etc., etc. But that was the beginning of what was happening in these secret prisons and the kind of level of torture that was unheard of even in Saddam's time. And some of the pictures were taken by U.S. troops then of some of these victims. And this is, if you can see it, this is a dead body. And this is a new type of torture unheard of, but became infamous with this person because this is practiced to create fear and terror. This is the instrument. And they found, actually, in this bunker secret, they found these. This is, you know, you get charged, and they begin. And this is witnesses of people who were tortured in front of them. They would begin with the limbs so that you don't die. It's like drilling through your limbs, you bleed, and then they drill into the heart of a person or his brain. And that is the worst kind of torture you could think of. Well, how did everybody get out of this without being punished? No one was punished. This guy now is in the parliament again. Because this guy, Mithat al-Mahmoud, he is the supreme judge of Iraq. He is the highest authority, legal authority. Guess what? He was the highest authority in the time of Saddam. He was the one who was responsible for cutting the ears of every Iraqi soldier who refused to participate in the Iraq-Iran war. And the government brought him under a deal. You pass everything we want. And that's what's happened. He has become the tool of the government. Any opposition, any person, innocent, not everything. The easiest thing is an arrest warrant, a terror accusation, execution. Simple as that. Scratch of a pen. And he's still there. When they removed him because of his links to Saddam, the prime minister just a few months ago returned him, and he was upset that they removed him. He forced him back, basically. Well, this has been happening since 2005. It was only like 2011 in the LA Times that these reports begin to come up. Elite units under the office of Maliki linked to secret jail where detainees face torture. Okay? And this is kind of beginning to seep into the media. But that's really nothing. It was just 1 week ago. How many of you have heard about this? Raise their hand, about the Guardian report. Very few. Well, this is why, because the media here is responsible. It kind of insulates and covers. This is a big story in the UK. They have found a Pentagon link to Iraqi torture centers, and actually directly to General David Petraeus and Donald Rumsfeld. Through this person, Steele, he is a veteran who was sent there to create, similar to the El Salvador situation, special units that were military equipped by the U.S. and were trained to go and attack the other sect, kill, torture, everything, freehand. And they're under their auspices and under their direct knowledge. And this is the result. This is in 2005. Bodies in Baghdad. 3,000 bodies was collected from the street of Baghdad each month. 3,000. All of them innocent, taken from their homes, taken to these torture chambers, and then thrown out as a way of fear, as a way of terror to the people, inhabitants. You leave or otherwise, this is a sectarian. This is one sect against the other. This is how it all began, and it continued. These were the bodies. Everybody was even afraid to go and remove them. So this is the role of how the U.S., because there was an insurgency, this is the way they fought it. They said, okay, the insurgency is mostly Sunni, so we're going to make the police, these special brigade police, Shia, and give them a free hand. And they did that. Well, this is a picture. This is what's called the SWAT, the SWAT, the same ones we have here. They were actually trained on the same, but not for the purpose of what SWATs do here. It's purpose of serving the government. They attack anybody who is considered a threat to the government. And they are feared because anybody who goes with them usually doesn't end up or stays in jail forever. And these are, and they even kind of learned or imitated the kind of bravado of U.S. Troops and wearing these masks and you know, these are the kind of checkpoints that are everywhere. And why do I have these pictures? Well, this is relevant to the human rights and the prisoners that what has happened. This was going on in prisons, and everybody was knowing about it, but people were afraid. If they speak up, they will end up like them in the prison. So how is this different from the time of Saddam? It is worse, because at the time of Saddam, it was against political rivals or people who are politically. Here, it was basically on sect, because the government is driving this sectarian drive for its own benefit and control. So one of the first people to speak up was this parliamentarian named Mohammed Daini, who went, and his crime was take a video and interview prisoners without knowing the government knowing, and just took them by surprise and published it and made a big fuss about it. Immediately, there was a warrant arrest against him. He managed to escape. He's still outside the country, and he has been the verdict is that to be executed, that he is in absentia. The second person, this guy, who was heading the unit of the welfare of prisoners. So he was doing the same thing. He was raising awareness about what's going on to the prisoners. And surely they took him in. He wasn't as powerful as a parliamentarian. So they took him into prison. They forced out of him a confession. They aired it on the TV, and they executed him. And they made a fantastic Hollywood-like drama of how he killed things and so on. And they even had actors do what they did and so on, just to kind of sell this. And he is from the opposite sect and so on, just because he was looking after the welfare of prisoners. The third victim He is the vice president. People might have known his face. He took on the same thing. He was going to prisons and he was raising awareness. And surely enough, there was an arrest warrant and accusations made against him. And he's escaped. And now he's also has a death sentence against him by the legal system in Iraq. So what does Human Rights Watch say? Human rights conditions in Iraq remain poor, particularly for detainees, journalists, activists, and women and girls. Security forces continued to arbitrarily detain and torture detainees, holding some in secret jails. Iraq, a broken justice system. 10 years after invasion, opponents punished, trial rights ignored. And this is summarized by Amnesty. New order, same abuses. Unlawful detentions and torture in Iraq. This is the new Iraq. This is 10 years after the invasion. This is the democracy. And if that wasn't enough, just to kind of the icing on the cake, Iraq is ranked 169 most corrupt country in the world out of 174. Okay? And it doesn't stop there. The kind of human rights abuses is so subtle that, according to sect in Baghdad, the people are cordoned like this, just like in Palestinians in the West Bank are cordoned with these walls, the same thing. And there's only one entry. There are checkpoints. There are humiliating checkpoints. And always reminded that we can do anything we want to you anytime. So a revolution started in 2011, and that was against the corruption, against the political system, against everything that was going wrong. Spontaneous, not attached to any political party or movement, people went out into the center square of Baghdad. And it continued. But it was systematically targeted by identifying their leaders and then either giving them money, trying to buy them, or detaining them, or if that didn't help, killing them. This is one of the leaders. He was a very famous journalist on radio, and he was always attacking the government. He was leading and supporting the revolution then and the young people. So this is from his Facebook just hours after, hours before he got killed. He says, "Enough. I have lived the last 3 days in the state of terror. There are some who call me and warn me of raids and arrests of protesters. There is someone saying that government will do this and that. There is someone with a fake name coming to threaten me on Facebook. I will take part in the demonstrations, for I am one of its supporters. I firmly believe that the political process embodies a national economic and political failure. It deserves to change, and we deserve a better government. In short, I do not represent any political party or any other side, but rather the miserable reality in which we live. I am sick of seeing our mothers beg in the streets, and I am sick of news of politicians' gluttony and of their looting of Iraq's riches." Hadi al-Mahdi, that was his name. He was found dead in his home. And he was, by the way, a Shia from the same sect of the government, but he stood against that that they represented. 2012, demonstrations have been going on for now 2.5 months in hundreds of thousands. And the same thing is happening to them. Their leaders are being identified. They are beginning to get assassinated. There are arrest warrants, just as simple as that, at every speaker and every leader of these demonstrations. They are peaceful demonstrations, and they want to change. They feel that this is enough is enough. And these are the places, the Ambar, the this one, and the Mosul, Salah al-Din, Ta'mim, Diyala, and in Baghdad, it was crushed, and it is continuing till today. But there is no media coverage of it, and there is no interest, and the U.S. government is turning a blind eye to what's going on, and they're supporting the government fully. So I want to end with these two cartoons that really represents what happened. This is in Arabic, Iran, and this is the Maliki, and this is Bush. He was angry, not following his orders. And then this was followed by this, when Obama said, "It's all yours, I'll leave it up to you." And so this is really what has happened, is that Iraq, after 10 years, is in a state that is on the brink of being fractured, on the brink of sectarian war, and destruction similar to what's happening to Syria. But we, as a positive note, can try and make something about it, can make a difference, can talk to our Congress men and women and try and tell the government that you did this, at least take a moral stand against all that the Iraqis have suffered. And thank you.
And now our final speaker this evening will be Mike Davis.
I was speaking at an anti-war rally in Red Lion Square in London. And I asked my comrades a question, whether they thought that somewhere in that vast labyrinth called the Pentagon, perhaps hidden in a broom closet or maybe buried deep in some underground bunker, there was a Bureau of History, somewhere where a couple of old clerks sat cutting out yellowed pages from newspapers talking about the death of an entire British army in Mesopotamia in the First World War, or the crushing of an Iraqi revolution, the beginning of the Second World War, all those things that you should know before you invade another country. And of course, there is no Bureau of History. There hasn't been, and seemingly there will never be. Which is why we're likely in this country to keep repeating history not as farce, but as carnage. And somebody should inform the President of the United States that as long as American foreign policy is shackled by the ankles to the Israeli right, the Middle East is like the Hotel California. It's easy to check into. It's almost impossible to check out. I'm very proud of being allowed to participate in this. I mean, I have to say, and I'm sorry to say, exceptional event, an act of resistance in the name of memory at a time when seemingly, who remembers the Iraq war? Who cares where the car bombs go off tomorrow? And so it's always the task of progressives, it's historical memory, to keep those memories alive. I was going to talk a bit about Baghdad tonight, but I'm going to skip that. And I want to talk, I don't know what I am, culture critic? I suppose I'm a kind of uncredentialed geographer of sorts. And I want to talk briefly about two geographies in our own backyard that have emerged because of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. The first, of course, it's been the creation in San Diego County and throughout Southern California of what you might call the Middle East simulated war space. Now, we have a fundamental problem here. There's an eye disease that seems to be particularly universal in San Diego County, and it afflicts not only people who lived here for a long time, but it afflicts almost everybody who visits. I've had the most left-wing friends come to stay with me, and I ask them, well, what do you think of San Diego? And they say, oh, it's great, the weather, beautiful bay, you know, wet T-shirt contest, beach volleyball, the Chargers. So I take them up to the roof of my garage. I have a little deck up there. And I just go through the catechism of statistics. 100,000 active duty Marine and Naval personnel, another 30,000 employees of the Department of Defense, 200,000 people who are indirectly paid by the Department of Defense. Maybe they're mechanics building Predators in Poway, like my biker neighbor across the street. The military more is important today in the San Diego economy as it was 75 years ago. And then from the top of my garage, we just look at the horizon. 10 amphibious assault ships capable of ferrying the entire 1st Marine Division anywhere in the world. 30 major surface combat ships, including the beginnings of the new littoral combat fleet, the fleet of the 21st century. The Navy's amphibious warfare center with half the Navy SEALs. Naval Station North Island with the nuclear weapons and the bunkers on the Point Loma side of North Island. 20 or 25 naval air squadrons, 2 nuclear carriers, 7 nuclear submarines at their base in Point Loma, Spar Wars in this immense complex of naval research and technology, including those now, oh, I think programs exist now for almost 35 years, the so-called marine mammal weapons platforms, which you sometimes see diving in and out of the bay, the dolphins and now sea lions that the Navy used in both Gulf Wars. This is the greatest concentration of potential violence on the face of the earth. This is unquestionably the most militarized city in the world. And the beginning of memory is, first of all, just simply being able to see what's in front of us. It's like we're camped in front of the pyramids and we're talking about how nice the desert is, but the overtowering fact of the violence in this landscape somehow has become invisible to us. Since the invasion of Iraq, the second Gulf War, something very strange has been created. As the Army and Marines, the special warfare groups, have stumbled into combat situations resembling more like Stalingrad or Northern Ireland. As they've been forced to win the hearts and minds of the locals, it's given enormous impetus to train troops, of course, in realistic simulations of urban environments or rural landscapes. First of all, in Iraq, now a few names are being changed, and it's Afghanistan. I hate to anticipate 3 years from now what they're going to be calling or what language they're going to be speaking in these villages. But again, just to enumerate, $33 million combat immersion facility at Camp Pendleton. There are 9 urban combat training centers on the base. 9 combat towns. You can see 2 of them if you drive up the I-5. Look like fire bases or villages in Afghanistan. And like their equivalents at Fort Irwin, 29 Palms, and in Yuma, they employ Arab speakers, actors. Everything has to be as real as possible. They're constantly recycling the combat experiences into these simulations, including how to occupy people, how to come into their living rooms, what to say. Everything has to be as realistic as possible. About 35 miles east of Camp Pendleton is the SER Center in the mountains just above Warner Hot Springs, a little town I think probably some of you may have visited, may not, kind of a cool place. And SER is, of course, survival, evasion, resistance, escape. When the U.S., when the Pentagon was trying to defend waterboarding, they pointed out that American pilots are waterboarded in the simulations of, you know, being imprisoned and tortured. This happens right here in Warner Hot Springs. Drive out I-8, you may notice something, a little turnoff. It's a little poster road, eventually hooks up to 94. La Posta used to be a naval radar base. It is now Afghanistan. It is the Navy and Marines' man warfare training center. A little closer to San Diego, Lake Marina, there's Camp Marina, which has been used in, over the last decade by the National Guard engineers who are building the wall along the border. And by the way, everywhere in San Diego, the control of the border overlaps or interlaces somehow with the wars in the Middle East. It's now been turned just, I think, in the last year into a new SEAL training center. No idea what goes on there. Jump in your plane at Lindbergh Field to fly anywhere, and if you sit on the starboard side, you'll see San Clemente Island. It's almost directly west of here, okay? About 40 miles out there. It's probably the most valuable asset that the U.S. military possesses in all of California. It's been bombed and invaded continuously since the Second World War. And recently, the military completed a $7 million American embassy. Why do we have an American embassy to San Clemente Island? Because, again, we want realistic conditions to simulate attacking an embassy, liberating an embassy. All this goes around us. And, of course, it's also right here. It's right in this campus. It's in the nation's second biggest complex of intelligence and surveillance, et cetera, homeland security research, pumped right out of the Jacobs School of Engineering. Last time I was on this campus, Go Library, about a year ago, I was going by one of the Jacobs buildings, and there were a bunch of boards up showing student work. And it was called 24/7. And it was six different PhD engineering projects, all involving, you know, new algorithms and so on, you know, for surveillance. This university, this campus of the University of California, is deeply implicated in U.S. wars abroad and in militarism, as is UC Berkeley with the notorious Livermore Laboratories. No more comment, but this is a geography that surrounds us, and it's enormously important that we take some interest in it and actually see it to get over this eye disease we have. The second geography, of course, has been the emergence of a culturally and economically vibrant Iraqi community, especially in the El Cajon Spring Valley area. Some 25 or 30,000 people, you hear all kinds of different figures, at least 10,000 of them live in the El Cajon area. Most of them are Chaldean Catholics. And El Cajon, where I grew up, has in the last 20 or 30 years undergone a very strange reinvention as a religious center. It has three of the major mega churches in San Diego County, the wonderful Unarian Society, who are waiting for the peaceful convergence to the 32 inhabited planets of the galaxy in order to create a socialist world civilization powered by Tesla's towers. Lots of stuff. But the most important fact is that it's now the center of a new diocese in St. Peter's Cathedral. I don't know. I'm sure some people in the audience are Chaldeans. If not, I urge you to visit St. Peter's, and if possible, attend Mass, particularly when it's said in Aramaic. This is the ancient Church of the East, the part of it which reconciled itself to the Vatican, but the rituals and the rites are completely different. There are also Assyrians, Church of the East, which did not reconcile with Rome, Shias, Sunnis. My high school, which when I graduated in 1964, it was divided between the bourgeois kids who lived north of Main Street and us Okies who lived south of Main Street, is now one of the most diverse high schools in California, and I think probably about 25% Chaldean. Now, the Chaldean immigration predates even the first Gulf War. Already by the 1970s, St. Peter's existed as a parish. There were a couple hundred families registered there. Now, St. Peter's counts over 10,000 registered worshipers. I think it's somewhere in the line of 3,000 families. And El Cajon has become very distinctively one of these old first-generation suburbs, and you find them all over the country, who just at the point where they're about to collapse and die. I mean, look, in El Cajon, J.C. Penney's became the Salvation Army, and the Salvation Army closed a few years ago. What is life after the Salvation Army? Like other geriatric immediate post-war suburbs, it's been reinvigorated by an extraordinary ethnic immigration. What theory of history could have predicted that El Cajon, California would be Little Baghdad, or that the Scandinavian smorgasbord where my father used to have lunch every day is now a really fine restaurant called Alibaba's? Growth of the Chaldean Iraqi community in San Diego also poses a problem, which has been the burden and dilemma of so many groups that have immigrated to the United States, displaced by war, invasion, driven out by disease. And that is what happens when complex layered identities, such as those of Baghdadi Christians, fluent in Arabic, going to Aramaic and Chaldean masses, citizens of multiple cultures, immigrates. What happens to their kids? And the dreary answer so often in American history has been the simplification of identity and the collapse of the different layers of complexity into kind of essentialisms. And I say this, and forgive me to the Chaldeans in the audience here, I say this based on only a couple of conversations with one of the market owners on Main Street. I took Radio France there once, Radio Paris, I'm sorry. And he gave us an extraordinary account of what he thought was happening to his community. And he saw the biggest problem as being the deracination, the de-Arabization of young Chaldean Americans clinging to religious identity, but losing Arabic and losing the Arab identity. And he was eloquently outspoken about this. And he pointed out to us that this is one of the hidden costs of the Iraqi war, and indeed, of the entire cycle of war and devastation in the Middle East. As religious and ethnic and linguistic minorities leave, or in some cases are literally expelled, it not only impoverishes the culture they left behind, which in the case of Iraq, I mean, Baghdad is a cosmopolis. Ibn Battuta visited Baghdad in the 12th century. He talked about, even though it's now overshadowed by Cairo, what an incredibly cosmopolitan place it was, with communities of Jews, Christians, Chinese, Indians, and so on. But what happens to people in immigration? What happens in exile? And I think from the standpoint of understanding the impact of the Iraq War on San Diego and of the Iraqis who live in San Diego, that may be the largest hidden cause. Their children's loss of their identity as members of Arab culture and Arabic language. I keenly look forward to hearing what some of you in the audience had to say about this. Thank you.
Feel free to ask questions of anyone on the panel.
Yeah, as far as if one of you could give some of the historical context in terms of providing, you know, some balance, specifically the period from the time that Saddam Hussein nationalized oil to the first Gulf War, in terms of, I know he's very much demonized as being undemocratic, but I think to give some balance to it in terms of his using the oil monies to build infrastructure, education, the role of women education-wise, career-wise, if somebody familiar with that period could provide some context so that we have a better idea of the quality of life of people at that time and the progress they were making versus what they're faced with now after the invasion.
I can answer that because I lived during that period there. And there was definitely a lot of investment in infrastructure. There was a designation that state-of-art hospital, tertiary educational teaching hospital in each of the provinces, in each of the 18 provinces. There were highways built. There were all kind of major building in terms of water, sanitation, sewage, everything. Believe it or not, these are the same infrastructure that are still today functional, and nothing substantial was added to it. So the life was that you can prosper, you can live, you can become educated, you can do, as long as you don't cross the line politically, you don't go against it, then, you know, everything is fine, almost. You know, there are exceptions, of course. But what has happened is that there's been no electricity now, 10 years. It comes 2 hours a day. Can you believe a country as big and as prosperous as Iraq, there is no electricity? So in summary, you know, just the interest of time, yes, there was a lot of investment, infrastructure, all the hotels that are still now standing, everything else was built during that period.
And also the role of women.
Yes, of course, the women had more freedom than probably any other neighboring country, except probably in Iran during the Shah period and so on. But it was a very open, you know, when I was there as a physician, my chief resident was a woman. Our professors were, you know, women and men. There was no such thing as discrimination, I guess.
Okay. A question either for Wael or Ibrahim. With regard to the demise of the higher educational system in Iraq, I graduated from Baghdad University a long time ago. And what you see today, especially under the current Minister of Higher Education, Ali Ladib, it looks like professors are being either banished, fired, executed, all of the above, including a death squad within the Ministry of Higher Education under his auspices. Would you like to make a comment on that and the demise of the educational system in Iraq when it was really the highest caliber that existed in the Middle East?
Do you
want to
start?
Yes, I mean, that's another system. I talked about the health system because of interest of time. I didn't talk about the educational system, which was, again, top tier. Our professors were graduates of the UK, US, and Western Europe. The highest, like the minister and maybe the university president had to be affiliated with the Ba'ath Party. But even that person was qualified. Now we have a ministry of sectarianism. Again, like the Minister of Health example, this guy, he's the second person in the Dawah Party, the ruling party, and he is makes no secret that he is targeting any people who are not from his sect, removing them and putting people from his party or who are loyal to him and from his sect. And by doing that, destroying really the whole notion of freedom of academia and freedom of professors. And people are fleeing, are afraid, and the situation is really, some of them got killed, yes.
And, you did have situations... the situation, let's say, after 2003, where even your students could kill you if you didn't give them an A, for example, which, if that was here today, I would be dead, you know. Just to give you an example. Prior to 2003, I have kind of a mixed experience with, and that after 2003, I was given the first time to interact with Iraqi historians, who were historians... from Iraq, that is. I shouldn't say, you have Iraqi historians, of course, in exile, but I was given a chance to interact with historians from Iraq, that is. And it's hard to, judge in that, a good number of the historians just didn't have access to outside information, and that cutting-edge journal, well, I shouldn't say cutting-edge journals, but journals, outside information was hard to come by. And, of course, history is not... Of course, history is embedded in the politics as well. So, it's... you had an advanced education system, but when it came to kind of the social science or the humanities, yeah, I did find it that kind of historians had to toe the party line, so to speak. So it was quite advanced, but, of course, they had to toe the party line. And then you have to then keep in mind you had a whole decade of sanctions, where they just simply couldn't access any information. And I found, from 1991, academia in Iraq began to suffer as a result of the sanctions period.
Hi, I'm a student here. I have a question for Mr. Al-Murashi. So when it came to light that they plagiarized your paper, it must have been pretty shocking for you. I'm wondering why it took so long for this to come to light, or why it didn't have a bigger effect on the course of the war, or should it have? Thank you.
It's a good question. I think maybe it maybe received attention, a couple of headlines in the U.S., and then quickly got subsumed by other events. Maybe it was just an inconvenience to the narrative that had already been woven. It was an inconvenient story that to a nation that was gearing up to the war. And I think by that time, the media had very much kind of began towing the line that Iraq was a kind of threat, existential threat, if you will, to U.S. national security. I mean, remember, this was still just 2 years after 9/11. And so if to kind of paraphrase from Al Gore, it was an inconvenient truth, if you will. And that was it. I mean, of course, in the UK, it had a much larger impact. The story there carried on for a good 6 months. I testified in the British Parliament about what did, the plagiarism of this dossier mean. So it was just inconvenient. It wasn't the right time, so to speak. It came out really maybe just a day after Powell made a speech that this document was plagiarized. But yeah, it did not get much attention. It was just inconvenient.
Some of us were following Ibrahim's career in those years very, very carefully. And then I learned from Hassan that Ibrahim had been a student here. And this was extremely exciting to me because, We were following these events and this unbelievable development of this plagiarized thesis as the document of intelligence. It was really, can you imagine, Powell was waving it in front of the UN General Assembly. So some of us were aware of Ibrahim a long time ago. Next, please.
I wonder if the panel... before we conclude, would like to speculate on what they see as the near-term future in Iraq.
I can just answer really quickly. It's still too early to tell. Still, even 10 years after, I mean, you have to realize a lot of these... It is a question, but as a historian, it's not a cop-out because, you know, I mean, if you... I could go back in the 1920s and see, okay, you know, I could see how these really, you know, I could trace back Saddam Hussein's, let's say, rise to power in Iraq and kind of find continuity with events that began in the 1920s. He officially became president in 1979. That's a long period of time. And, you know, who could have imagined actions undertaken, let's say, under the British mandate of Iraq could have ramifications a good 60 years later. So that's why, as a historian, when I say it's too early to tell, I really believe it. It's not a cop-out.
I may venture and say, look to what happens to Syria. I think what happens to Syria is going to affect Iraq dramatically because this is part of this puzzle, and Iran has a role in this as well. So I think it could go either way, but it is now very precarious because of all these demonstrations, and the government is stalling, is kind of beginning to target, beginning to detain. If this is going to continue, it could blow up. If somebody becomes reasonable and try and address this, then there could still be hope.
Yes, please. It was very interesting to listen to a group of people who are very familiar with Iraq and know what's going on. My question is, isn't it better with all the confusion in Iraq, the revolt? No one is happy in Iraq, I think, to divide Iraq to three different regions, as was proposed by Mr. Biden some times ago. Maybe that would have been the best solution, and you didn't have any of these problems. So please, I'd like to hear your view about that.
I'll have a quick response. You remember Yugoslavia? When it was broken down and the wars that happened. So I think this is not a solution. If this is going to be like that, this is going to be like the Bosnians, the Croat, and the Serbs, and so on. So I think that's not a valid solution in the short term, at least.
Also, let me kind of clarify. I mean, kind of the conventional knowledge is this. The British came, they stuck together three Ottoman provinces and created Iraq out of geostrategic oil interests. And, you know, when I say that's a conventional knowledge, you also have to, I mean, realize that there, I mean, at least as a cultural entity, there was a notion of Iraqiness even before the British came. Okay, so, I mean, to cut up Iraq into three convenient pieces... Again, if I can make a rough analogy, okay, sure, perhaps, if we want to stick with this kind of conventional knowledge, I'll say this. Sure, Iraq might have been an arranged marriage and that the British was the matchmaker, but who is the U.S. decades later, if the marriage was forced, who is the U.S. decades later to force a divorce, that is? That was Biden's plan. And yeah, and then when I heard it, I was like, okay, if you want to believe Iraq was a forced marriage, then again, who is America to force a divorce? In other words, usually when foreign powers come in and kind of draw borders, it's never a good outcome. It wasn't a good outcome back in the 20s, and it wouldn't be a good outcome and, you know, a good process to partake in 2013. Hassan, yeah, this is your perspective.
No, but to some extent, a de facto divorce has happened in Iraq, especially in the north, in the Kurdish regions. In that sense, you know, the picture today is very different from, you know, what was the case in the mandate. So in that sense, you know, this is not an ideal solution at all, but I think this is sort of a valid question, a more valid question today than it was, you know, certainly pre-occupation and... earlier in the century.
If I could just quickly go with that marriage analogy. then which is better? Is it the divorce or the unhappy marriage? And sometimes I think about that. Is there such a thing as a happy marriage? I mean, in other words, no, if you look at kind of Scotland vis-a-vis the United Kingdom or Catalonia vis-a-vis Spain, and it's, you know, these are all unhappy marriages. But sometimes the formal divorce would be a lot worse than kind of ignoring the obvious truth that these, you know, that it's not a happy union.
I think it's even worse than that because there are suitors around.
Yes, you know? Yeah, true.
And of course, to build on Ibrahim's analogy, no one wants to be divorced by order of Joseph Biden. Thank you very much. Thanks, everyone, for coming.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.